ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Sarah, I declare your allegiance. Which Pride and Prejudice adaptation is your favourite?
Well, this is an easy one. It has to be and can only be the 1995 adaptation, which I watched with a bunch of my Australian flatmates in London in about 2000. The boys would comment on the women's outfits, particularly the princess-style dresses that enhanced the bosom. And we did it all together. It was really, I have really fond memories of this time and watching this series.
Yeah, I am a 1995 girl too. I know lots of people love the Keira Knightley one, but for me, any sick day, when I think about the fact that I can watch all of those episodes and just absolutely bask in it, it's beautiful. And I think that adaptation is so loyal to the book.
Oh, yeah. And I think that for a lot of people, don't you agree, Claire? Pride and Prejudice is the jewel in Austen's crown. It's a favourite of so many people, probably myself included.
Yeah, it's her second novel, and I think it is really a perfect example of what makes Jane Austen so fantastic. There's this great romance, the characters are so funny. But this is really nerdy of me, Sarah, but what I get quite giddy about is the plotting. This is a perfect example of the classic marriage plot. Everyone in this book is here for a reason. Every conversation counts and everything is going to fit together perfectly by the time you've finished reading.
You're not a nerd, Claire, but it is, I agree, it is like, this perfect piece of embroidery, all those threads coming together.
And, you know, it's something that authors today still look at and marvel at. They want to learn Jane's secrets. And Sarah, you and I have convinced one of these modern day legends to come and rave about Ms. Austen with us today. Colm Tobin, a hugely acclaimed Irish writer, author of Brooklyn and Long Island. Colm, what a thrill to have you here for this. Thank you.
Thanks for asking me.
Colm, you better lay out your Jane Austen credentials.
I've been teaching Mansfield Park and Pride and Prejudice, and Persuasion indeed, over the last while at Columbia University as part of a course in, you know, just looking at the growth of consciousness, especially of a woman, leading on to, say, George Eliot, leading on to Henry James, leading on to Edith Wharton. Actually, in the end, some of those books, the more you study them and disentangle them, deconstruct them, I suppose, the more perfect they seem.
And Sarah?
Yes, Claire?
Make sure you listen closely here, because Colm has a kind of code for how to crack the secrets of a Jane Austen novel. The first is, if someone's in the Navy, they're always good. Right, Colm?
You know, Jane Austen's brothers were in the Navy. She loved the Navy. If Navy officers had arrived, they would be impeccably dressed, their manners would be beautiful, and they would have made some money. I mean, out of plunder, basically, but she doesn't mention plunder.
Because she's a Navy girl.
She loves a sailor. In Jane Austen, anyone who's in the Navy is good, anyone who's in the Army is bad, and anyone who's inherited money is suspect. And this is a great moment in early 19th century, a time of peace in England, when a lot of the sailors, a lot of the Navy people have come back on land. There are no more wars to fight for the moment. And she can then romance them. She can then, play with them. She can ironize them.
Okay, so Navy good, Army bad. I've got that.
But now let's look more closely at the brilliant way Ms. Austen plots her books. And let's focus on Pride and Prejudice here because, well, it's our favourite. And it's the book, I guess, a lot of us know the best.
And at the centre is Elizabeth Bennet, our bright but, poor heroine, and Fitzwilliam Darcy, the proud rich man who kind of has to get over himself and fall in love with her. And then there's their preposterous friends and family and all the expectations swirling around that stand in their way.
And, of course, the book starts with, it's got to be one of the most famous opening lines ever.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife.
Indeed. But Colm Tobin, it's what comes immediately after that opening line. That's where the real genius is on show.
The opening pages of Pride and Prejudice are extraordinary. because you don't get a physical, it's only Mr. Bennett talking to Mrs. Bennett.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get a physical description. Are they tall? Are they small? And you don't get a pluperfect, mm-hmm. which is the enemy of the novel, to go, 20 years ago, she had been, when she had met, her father had been, this had been, it just is a clunky sound in English anyway, it had been. But what you do is you get the idea that Mr. Bennett as a sardonic mm-hmm. fellow and Mrs. Bennett as flighty, moving towards silly, and you don't get, the rooms are not described,
mm-hmm.
how they met, how in the name of God they ever wanted to get married to each other.
That's
just
a mystery.
It's just left as another thing that we just have to deal with. But it is, and but what's coming is that these new people have moved into Netherfield, and Mrs. Bennett desperately needs to marry her daughters, because if they don't marry, they're penniless because of a whole system of that only a man can inherit. So you get in that first episode, using dialogue alone, a full version of the personalities of two people, plus you get the plot of the book that this, a new thing has occurred. These rich people have moved in. What are they going to be like? And then Mr. Bennett listens for ages to his wife, speculating on them and how rich they are and how nice they are and how beautiful they are. And then he just lets her know that, oh no, I've already been to visit them. And she said, well, why didn't you say that? And the reader is already enjoying the drama between them. But as you say, there are little figures such as Mr. Collins, who is the silliest man mm-hmm. in fiction. And there are silly women in Austen. She loves doing silly women, but by God, is he useless. And, you know, but as a minor character, of course, he has an importance. Not only that he works for Lady Catherine de Bourgh, but he's going to inherit. And then he marries Elizabeth's friend, and she goes to visit them, which allows her, in another way, to see Darcy. So there are a whole lot of different ways that a figure like Mr. Collins is not merely a side character followed through in the book, but he has an essential element, essential role to play in the plotting of the book, as does, for example, Lady Catherine de Bourgh, as does the aunt in London. And so, yes, you're absolutely right that these minor characters seem minor, and then they move, and she knows how to move them or how to use them. And that's spectacular.
It's fun to imagine how she must have worked if she had these plots really intricately detailed out, or she figured out how to kind of fit people into the story as she went along.
Yeah, I mean, I think that having someone as silly as Mr. Collins and then realising that he could actually move between the two households, I don't think you can get that before you start working. You realise, mm-hmm. oh, I know what I can do. I could have him working for Lady Catherine de Bourgh, and then so that somehow I'm now connecting the two households and I'm watching her as such an imperious person. And so you have then levels of imperiousness arising from inherited wealth. Lady Catherine de Bourgh's imperiousness versus the Bingley girls. But there's a wonderful moment where they're sitting quietly at home, the Bennett girls, and a lot of noise, a carriage and all sorts have come. And, you know, there's a lot of noise, and suddenly Jane Austen writes, and it must have been such fun that day, it was Lady Catherine de Bourgh. This is before film. I mean, we think, oh, surely she was using. No, this is what film came from. You know, the music,
yeah.
And then and then bigger of Lady Catherine de Bourgh, as played by Margaret Rutherford or someone, appears. So there must have been moments when she took pure pleasure.
We're celebrating 250 years of Jane Austen here on The Book Show. I'm Claire Nichols. And Sarah Lestrange, we are here with Colm Tobin to talk about Jane Austen's mastery of plotting.
And when I think of Pride and Prejudice, the parties, they seem really important. There's that big dance at the start, the Netherfield Ball. But this is a chance for Jane Austen to bring a bunch of these characters into the same room.
Yeah, I love these scenes. Colm, how important are these social events?
You have a big party, or just say you have the ball at Netherfield.
Mm-hmm.
You know, new people have moved into the area. They seem to have money, and they give a big ball. And these girls, these Bennett girls, who are very well educated and seem entitled in some way, also have no money. And they've also got very good manners. And so two of them are invited to the ball. There's Elizabeth and there's Jane. And the important thing, however, is not the ball. It is the next day, when Jane Austen then has to give Elizabeth a sort of way of noticing and remembering and feeling that belongs to her alone. She doesn't share. She doesn't need to speak. It is just how she thinks about things, how she considers things. And some of what she considers are actually quite important things to do with society. Is this working well enough that Mr. Bingley seems to have Shawnee's light on her sister? Will this last? If it doesn't last, what damage will it do to Jane, who's quite brittle, who's quite sensitive? Mm. Like, are these people just playing with these local girls? Or, you know, is there real life in London? So she has to speculate on this, and you can see her as a most sensible and intelligent and tactful person. And that means the book then can proceed, because we've seen that since she is the most sensible person in the book, because the Bingley women are really so entitled, because they're rich, they're going to inherit money. They're just lazy intellectually and entitled and of no value. So we're getting this idea of value. What does value come from? Value comes from good sense. It comes from a good way of analysing, but it also comes from being tactful and good-mannered always in a room, and also being articulate, but knowing when to be silent. Mm. So we watch this idea in England of the notion of value changing from inherited money, which the Bingleys have, to self-invented good sense. Because the Bennet girls, their mother is the silliest creature alive.
And I love her so much.
She's a comic figure, however. And the father is so sort of grumpy and sardonic that the two daughters, have not inherited their good manners. They've invented their good manners. So we're talking about self-invention in a time, of course, when people in business could also self-invent. You didn't have to inherit money to become rich. We know this because Jane Austen is really good on the subject of aunts. That when the mother is missing or silly, you bring in aunts. Mansfield Park has mm-hmm. two aunts. Lady Russell in Persuasion is a sort of surrogate aunt. But of course, it's terribly important. I mean, Pride and Prejudice depends on Lady Catherine de Bourgh is an aunt. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's Darcy's aunt. And she is entitled, you know, she has a way of dealing with him. She can be imperious without actually having to be nurturing, you know. And, similarly, the aunt in London, Elizabeth's aunt. Mm. They have made money. They are people in trade. And yet they seem to be highly developed systems of good manners and tact and seriousness. So we're watching England change.
And that's because the Gardeners, that's Elizabeth's aunt and uncle, have made their own money. And what does that mean, Sarah?
They're not to be suspect.
Yay, that's right. I love all these little hints for how to read Austen. So we've got Navy good, Army bad, inherited wealth, suspect. We also know that aunts push story forward, and it's not the ball, but what happens after the ball that allows us to establish the themes of the story.
And in the case of Pride and Prejudice, the big idea that Austen is pushing is the value of good sense.
Exactly. Now, Colm Tobin, we've been talking about the genius of Jane Austen's plotting, and you have borrowed, perhaps, from Jane when it comes to your most famous novel, Brooklyn. Tell me how Jane, what do you call her? The divine Jane?
Henry James sarcastically was fed up people praising her and not praising him. And so he said, the divine Jane. In the opening of Brooklyn, before Eilish goes to America, she goes to a dance in the town. And it's a small town in Ireland, it's the 1950s. And of course, the crowd from the rugby club, who are all a slightly class above her, or two class, I mean, they own shops, arrive in wearing their blazers, and they all stick together. And as she goes up to the bars, or as she goes up to get a lemonade or something, one of them studies her, up and down, looks at her. And for a moment, it looks as though he might ask her to dance, which would be a very big move. And then he doesn't. And I think this half a sentence, literally taken as a joke, as an anchor, as a reference, as a sort of private thing from that moment at that first ball in Netherfield in Pride and Prejudice, where Darcy looks Elizabeth up and down and is almost going to move towards her. You can feel there's almost an attraction there. But because he's so proud, or because he's so acutely conscious of his social class, I took that straight from. And then, of course, later on in the book, he deeply regrets that. I mean, he tries to row back on it. But yeah, that's absolutely taken from him. But I think even more in the book, the idea of Eilish alone, you know, bringing her up to her bedroom and having her think, having her feel, having her conjure things up, that's, I suppose, the idea is taken from what Jane Austen did with solitude in her books.
Do you think authors do that a lot, go back to Jane and figure out, like, use her to help the crack scenes?
No, I don't. And I don't think enough people do. And sometimes I'm reading a book and say, if only... and I mean, I'm sorry to say they're usually blokes. If only this bloke, this big, you know, some of those American guys who you feel would be much better off if they were rock stars. You know, like, if only they would just look at Jane for a second. They would see this, there is a solution to this narrative problem that she does offer. Mm. And sometimes, yes. But when it's the answer is no, then there's always a problem.
Colm Tobin, thank you for sharing your love for the divine, Miss Austen.
The divine, Jane.
And Sarah, we'll have more on the Divine Jane next time in our series, Dear Jane.
We're going more sombre with Persuasion, but we do have comedian Alice Fraser, and she calls it the second chance romance.
Sarah, thank you. And to misquote Lady Catherine de Bourgh, I take no leave of you, Miss Lestrange. I send no compliments to your mother. You deserve no such attention. I am most seriously displeased.
Oh, to write like that. Happy birthday, Dear Jane.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.